Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, 40 years after the first Hmong refugees came to the San Joaquin Valley, we look back at the history and culture of this community that's become such a big part of our local culture. We'll also learn how California's avocado farmers are adapting to the drought and more. But first, we turn our attention to the world of education. Right now, districts across the state are putting the finishing touches on their spending plans for the new year. Many of them, especially those in the Valley, have an extra task this year, outlining how they plan on spending hundreds of millions in new funding that's supposed to provide new, improved services for low-income and other disadvantaged kids. There aren't a lot of rules on how districts can spend the money, but as FM 89's Jeffrey Hess reports, a recent letter from the state warning local officials on an important provision is attracting scrutiny and raising questions about whether some districts are following the spirit of the law.
The special funding, known as supplemental and concentration funds, is a big funding boost for schools to help the neediest kids, such as poor students, non-English speakers, and foster kids. It's part of the local control funding formula, intended to enable schools to provide new services to help them succeed in school. But there is a catch. Because the formula is so new, the state has not issued a set of guidelines about what it can and cannot be used for. Paul Warren with the Public Policy Institute of California says the ambiguity in the law is intentional, designed to free up schools to be creative with the needs of their students.
Because they don't want to get out there with a lot of rules right off the bat, right? They want to, as much as they can, give districts flexibility. But again, there's limits to that, and that's what we're exploring, right?
And that ambiguity has left districts in the Valley in an interesting spot of justifying their spending without hitting hidden speed bumps. However, Warren says there is one rule the state made clear in a recent letter to districts. The services must be new and specific, not just paying more for existing resources.
Supplemental concentration funds really are supposed to be targeted for services at those kids. So you could spend more money for extra teachers for those kids, right? But, you know, you couldn't give, say, the superintendent a raise.
But how the districts interpret what they can do with the funding varies from place to place. In her second floor office of Fresno Unified's downtown headquarters, Tammy Townsend's walls are covered floor to ceiling with charts and large sheets of paper laying out how they plan to help the most disadvantaged kids in the district. Fresno Unified is in line for about $126 million in supplemental and concentration funds on top of their base funding. Townsend says that is because so many of their students, 87%, fall into the three special categories.
Almost all of our kids are either foster youth, English learners, or living below the federal poverty level, with the vast, vast majority of our kids living below the federal poverty level.
From that perspective, Townsend says nearly everything they do will lead to improved educational outcomes for their students, including lower class sizes and longer school days. Townsend says something as small as making the elementary school day 30 minutes longer can have a big impact.
And some of the investments that we've made in early childhood education with preschool, many of our kids will have an additional 2 years of instruction before they go into middle school.
The district also wants to give teachers raises and benefit increases, in addition to hiring more janitors and doubling library funding. But the letter from the State Department of Education warns districts that the funds cannot be used for across-the-board raises and benefits unless those raises are tied to specific new programs. Townsend says they understand where the state is coming from, but that improving teacher pay and benefits is crucial to finding and keeping the best teachers. So helping adults does, in fact, help the kids.
And we recognize that, you know, with extreme poverty like you have in Fresno, there comes additional challenges for all of the adults in our system. So we want to be competitive. We want to be a place where people want to come to work.
The district is expected to negotiate wages and benefits with the teachers' union over the summer, and raises are likely to be a part of the conversation. The State Department of Education declined to comment, saying the letter speaks for itself, but also points out that it's hard to tell districts what is and isn't okay until districts ask, which hasn't happened yet, as this is the first year they have to submit their plans. Richard Martin with the Fresno County Office of Education says they understand across-the-board raises may be contrary to the goal of the law, but in some cases may be the only way to improve education for poor and underserved youth.
If you have 100% or close to 100% concentration grant district that's real high in either English learner or poverty, pretty much whatever you do for the whole district is going to help those students.
Martin says it's not hard to see how higher wages and other supplements can help those students, especially in rural areas.
One of the justifications would be, say, a small rural school district is losing its most highly qualified, experienced teachers because they aren't allowed to, they don't have the money or resources to give raises, and so they're losing their most experienced teachers.
But not all districts in the Valley are considering using concentration funds to increase teacher pay or benefits. Christian Shannon with the Kern County Office of Education says they don't think concentration funds can be used in that way, and that their districts are instead focusing on outreach, extra tutoring, and translation for parents.
Mentoring and counseling opportunities, assisting students with application to financial aid, which would cover decisions made by them for college or career actions, campus walks on college campuses, leadership training.
And there's a bigger long-term budgetary concern that could come into play, pension obligations. Tammy Townsend with the Fresno Unified District says some districts could become so overwhelmed by retiree benefits that they will have no choice but to spend concentration funds paying pension. It's not clear how the State Department of Education would react to that plan, let alone teacher wage hikes that appear to be in the works. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. 40 years ago, the Hmong people began seeking refuge in the United States. This, of course, after the CIA recruited a guerrilla army of Hmong people to fight the North Vietnamese in Laos in what's known as the Secret War. Before coming to the U.S., they spent years in refugee camps in Thailand. More than 15,000 of those refugees made it to America, where their lives changed forever. On our show today, we have several segments about the Hmong and their contributions to the local community. Right now, FM 89's Ezra David Romero speaks with a local Hmong family who made the journey. Here's their story.
Na Vang knew he had to get his family out of Laos during the Secret War, initiated by the CIA in the 70s. As a medic on the side of the Americans, he knew his family wasn't safe.
If we stayed, then he knew we wouldn't survive.
Na has five children. His 21-year-old daughter, Tara Vang, is translating for him.
My dad is saying we didn't know where to go or what to do. We just knew that General Vang Pao had left the country. So that was his thinking. If he's left, then we need to leave.
In the middle of the night, Vang, his wife, father, and son raced through the forest to escape the Vietnamese, who were searching for anyone affiliated with the Hmong who fought in the war. Vang's wife, Pai, can't forget that rainy night.
Leaving the country was really hard. We didn't know what was ahead of us. We didn't know if we were going to be killed or if we were going to survive.
When the family reached the Mekong River, separating Laos from Thailand, the water was high and rushing. The soaked family climbed into a boat with more than 50 others. Na's dad waited for the second boat. Reaching the shore safely, the three waited for their grandfather to arrive.
There was too many people, and the boat was really small. Everybody was trying to get on the first trip, but it didn't fit everyone. And the first trip, my parents were on it. They made it across, but the second boat trip did not make it. No one survived.
As the boat capsized, the family watched in horror, realizing they would never see their patriarch again. The loss of life wasn't just a reality for the Vang family. Thousands of people died fleeing Laos, and many more in refugee camps. When the family arrived at a refugee camp in 1976, they felt safe, but isolated.
Coming to Thailand was very difficult. No restrooms, nowhere to cook. You literally had to go to the woods to get wood. There was no water to drink in the refugee camps. They didn't know how to live.
The family survived off little to nothing in the camp.
They didn't even allow them to go out of the camps to collect wood to burn, to cook their food with. They had to wait for the Americans or the government to provide materials for them.
That aid didn't always come quickly. At times, a couple says they went hungry for days. 2 years later, the family came to the U.S. They boarded a plane clutching only what they could hold. A half a day later, they landed in Los Angeles, leaving everything familiar behind.
What was the day like when you found out you could come?
We didn't know what to think. We just knew we could never go back to where we had come from. We could only hope for the best for the future and to see where it would take us.
After making it through customs, the family was taken to a hotel that they'd call home for about a week. They had no idea what a hotel looked like, where to buy food, or where they would relocate. They met kindness through a hotel janitor.
My dad remembers this African-American man spent more than $19 of food for the family.
That man brought them to a fast food restaurant.
What did you order?
Hamburgers.
That's hamburger. So then finally we were able to eat a more substantial meal than just bread.
The next day, a Vietnamese translator they met at the airport helped the family relocate to Santa Barbara, where a small population of Hmong people lived. Shortly after settling, the family began yearning for produce grown in Laos.
My mom's biggest fear in leaving the country was, will I ever get to eat my green vegetables? Will I get to ever farm again? She said that she noticed that, you know, in America there was produce similar, but the taste was not the same.
So Mrs. Vang planted a small backyard garden with mustard seed she smuggled through customs.
The Hmong folks that had arrived at that time, they saw my mom's greens and they're just like, you have our food from the home country. Can you share, you know, some of the food? And then the next harvest, she shared her seeds.
The family called the Santa Barbara area home until 5 years ago. They uprooted and moved to the Central Valley to help support their son while he went to Fresno State.
And how has life been in Fresno for you?
It's good. It's really good for farming.
Their backyard corner lot in southwest Fresno is full of rows of veggies like
zucchini, leafy greens.
Oh, this is corn.
Squash.
Today, the Vangs have 5 grown children that live in Minnesota and in Fresno. They love the area because they can farm here, just like they did in Laos.
Do you ever miss your homeland?
I miss the landscape, but I do not miss the laws of the land. It's being run by communism. I would not want to go back.
With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition, and on our program today, we look back at 40 years of the Hmong people in America. It just so happens that the two largest populations of Hmong people in America are here in the Central Valley and in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul in Minnesota. We continue our program now as FM89's Ezra David Romero interviews Fresno State anthropologist Cao Li Yang, who studied the Hmong people for decades. She says each of these communities mirrors the two men who helped establish the Hmong in their respective regions.
Who are these leaders in each community?
The first one is the late former General Vang Pao, who passed away in Fresno in 2011. And the second man is Dr. Yang Dao. He lives in the Twin Cities. One is born in the 30s. And the other was born in the 40s. Two men from different background. How do these two men shaped the face of the two communities in the United States? So in the United States, you have mainly two big communities. The first one is in Fresno, the second one in the Twin Cities, and you have small communities everywhere.
How do these communities mirror the men that founded them?
The common features for the two populations is they are all farmers. They farm everywhere. Maybe a little bit more in Fresno than in the Twin Cities. One of the other main features is conversion into Christianity as well for the past 30 years. In the Twin Cities, you have more upper middle class. In Fresno, more middle class. In terms of life, Twin Cities, you have more jobs, so people have more money, have a better life.
How so?
It's the influence. Dr. Yang Dao was in France, and in the 80s, he came to the United States. So many people sponsored him to come to live in the Twin Cities. So he came in, he bring his passion for music, for art. In the Twin Cities, you have people with higher education, more women with PhD than here in Fresno.
Tell me about Dr. Yang Dao.
He has his PhD in France, so he's highly educated. He's also a man of dialogue as well. When he first came to the United States, he was teaching Hmong at the University of Minnesota for many years. He retired now. He's a man of culture. He composes sound. He also sings songs. So a modern man in that term.
You said he likes dancing too.
Yes, he danced tango very well. I have the opportunity to dance with him. He's a wonderful dancer as well.
So him being a modern man, how is it reflected in Twin Cities?
Well, you have a lot of people willing to follow the same path. For example, in terms of leisure time, in Twin City, I have the experience when I travel over there during weekend, I have to say I party a lot. I start by Friday night, I finish by Sundays. They do have plays to entertain in the evening. Plays for elderly, the 60, 70 years old. Plays for the 40, 50 years old. Yeah, plays for 30, 20 years old as well. In Fresno, you do have that only during the period of the Hmong New Year.
Twin Cities is a very different place in Fresno, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. you think it's a mixture of this man's ideals and the city?
Yes, the Hmong people are very competitive. My experience living in the United States is they love to imitate each other. And Dr. Yang Dao, who's remained for all of us a model, an intellectual model success, he's inspired young generation to go to higher education, get a PhD. In the Twin City, you do have more successful people with money, with comfort, with houses. In Fresno, we can have the economic background is also a factor to social success as well.
Here in Fresno, how does the Hmong community represent General Vang Pao?
We can say that in Fresno, the Hmong are more conservative. They want more to preserve culture and also to value more traditional value. For example, one of the key aspects in General Vang Pao's contribution is to set up the bride price.
Oh, the bride price.
Yes, when you marry, the husband pay a price for his wife. This is something that General Vang Pao did in Fresno, and this is something that is very, very traditional. Because for the mainstream society, you don't pay any more money for your wife. For General Vang Pao, it's necessary to set up a price, and everybody have to follow that rule.
Do you think Fresno is representative of General Vang Pao's education?
Yes, we can say that in that way. Because I'm thinking that instead of worry about bride price, it would be wonderful to promote, to create structures, organization to absolutely promote the students.
Would you say the Hmong have resettled better in Minnesota than in Fresno?
Yes, certainly, because they have, economically, it's also a better place. You have factories, people can work, find work easily. But also, they create a structure with several organizations. They have a day for the Hmong Cultural Center, December 1st or 2nd, and they have structure like archives, to social organization to help people.
So Fresno, in some sense, is behind the times for the Hmong population.
Yes, I believe we are. For example, in the years of 2000, in the Twin City, they start to talk about creating cultural centers. And so people try to move, and so they create the Hmong Cultural Center that has a website online. You have all the archives. Create the online Hmong journal. In Fresno, you don't have that. So you still live like farmers. You try your best as individual or family or lineage to support your children. You don't have those structure, in fact, with leaders, role model to inspire you. We don't know if Fresno is left behind, but the path of the Hmong community in Fresno is totally different. It's a different path.
How do you feel like Americanization is changing Hmong culture in Fresno and in Minnesota?
In Fresno, the internal structure, cultural practice, it doesn't change a lot. For the non-Christian, the animists, they still practice a traditional ritual shamanism. And for the Christian, they moved to the American style. But in the Twin City, you have still the same, but you have a different lifestyle that overlap the traditional lifestyle. For example, nightclub, going to dancing the evening, going to the bar to drink, those practices are not Hmong.
Do you think that General Vang Pao and Dr. Yang Dao thought, we want to make our communities look like us?
No, I don't think so. Dr. Yang Dao, he has been living in the in France for many years. He came to the United States. People wanted him to contribute to modernize the community. He did give his best to his community. We can say two men different. One is looking back, General Vang Pao. In 2011, when General Vang Pao passed away, I read all those newspapers to know what people think about at that event. And the French people, the newspaper Le Monde, wrote about General Vang Pao, and they said that his passing marked the end of the Cold War in Southeast Asia. Dr. Yang Dao is looking forward, and General Vang Pao has been leading a virtual war for many years until his passing. We can say that because General Vang Pao remained the father of all the Hmong. And when he passed away, suddenly the term that they are using to name him is a king. He was a kind of a king for the Hmong people.
How do you think the Hmong people, 40 years later, are holding on to their Hmongness?
If you study the history of the Hmong people, the Hmong have changed over the centuries. We are not the same like our ancestors were in the 15th century or in the beginning of the century. So the idea of being Hmong is to acknowledge that. And so if you want to emphasize the material aspect in order to be a Hmong, we don't have anything else to do with the Hmong anymore. The way we are dressing, the way we are eating, for example, our eating style, food are all Laotian. We don't eat our traditional food anymore. It may be a dish in addition to our everyday meals, but we don't eat like we used to eat 50 years, 40 years ago. So at the material level, it's changing, it's over. We are totally assimilated to the American way of living. But something that is crucial for the Hmong community is the language. So the identity is defined by the language. If you speak your language, you are Hmong. If you believe that you are Hmong, so you are Hmong. If you still give back to the community, so you are Hmong. So it's more value, and the key aspect is the language, value in the language. So if you hold on to your language, you want to learn language, so people, the community will perceive you as a Hmong. When you don't speak the language anymore, when you don't care about your community anymore, you live outside of the community, so you are not somehow Hmong.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you too.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We continue our discussion of the 40th anniversary of the Hmong migration to the U.S. with three community leaders. Joining us in our studio now, we have Blong Zhang, a former member of the Fresno City Council. He represented District 1 from 2007 to 2015. We also have Lar Yang, the Hmong Story 40 Project Director. We'll talk more about the events that are coming up this year and next as part of Hmong Story 40 in a moment. And also local writer Sol Vang. He wrote a book of poems called To Live Here. He is a poet, teacher, and U.S. Army veteran and holds an MFA in poetry from Fresno State. I want to start with you, Blong. When you look back and talk about, even think about this being the 40th anniversary, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think back at the fact that it's been 40 years now as we're celebrating this anniversary?
Well, besides how old I am, I guess, I look at the great accomplishment of really not this generation, but you look at what our parents and those that brought us here in terms of the type of limitations that they had and what they had to do, endure, and sacrifice to give our generation this opportunity. To appreciate it now that I'm older and having a larger grasp of the understanding of what it took. I totally give them the credit for what they've had to do to give us this.
And turning you to you, Sol, how big of a story is this 40th anniversary in the community right now as we talk about this, especially as we consider in 10 more years, many of the elders may not be here? How big is this for the Hmong community?
I think 40 years is a very symbolic benchmark. Like Blong said, it tells us how long we have been here. And for those of us who were born there and came here as children, 40 years, that means we have been here much longer than our parents were alive. I'm older now than my dad when he came. And so when they came, they were in their 30s, their 40s, they were very young. And so now it's like a generation has come of age and has changed. And so it's almost like it's time to kind of sit down and look back and look forward and kind of see, what our values are, what we retain, what we need to keep to as we go forward.
And turning to you, Lar Vang, again from the Hmong Story 40 Project, do you think the fact that, yes, you're going through and collecting these stories from the community, and we'll talk what you're going to do with them in a moment, but do you think the fact that you're just going through the process in the community and collecting these stories, does that also mark a point of self-reflection? And does that in itself change things in any way about just the community reflecting on itself and its place?
I think so. I think that we're at a very critical crossroads because I think this couldn't have happened, 10, 15 years ago because there weren't enough people in the right places. And now, it's a critical time because when we try to ask our questions for our elders in the future, they might not be around. And then if we don't take the time to actually build an archive to preserve those stories, we won't be able to captivate that kind of a narrative for our children. So the timing is very, very critical. And that's why I think so many of us are so passionately invested into creating and bringing this project to fruition.
This may be a question that a lot of people already know the answer to, but why the Central Valley? Why the San Joaquin Valley? Why did so many Hmong come to Fresno, Merced, in this area? And I don't know which one of you wants to take it. Blong, looks like you're jumping in here.
You look at Ag. That's where our community feel most comfortable. You come here as one of the most fertile part of the country, nation, and the world. And if you know a little bit about our history, when you talk about farming, whether it's from 1 acre to half an acre or to even large, that's kind of the basis and the background of our community. So coming into the Central Valley, even though we were first dispersed into different parts of the city and country, the valley you would think be a natural draw for our type of community and for what it brings.
And turning to you, Lar, your thoughts on that?
I think that having done a lot of these oral stories, I've come to realize that no matter where you are inside California, there's such a cluster of elders here in Fresno that no matter how far you leave the country, leave the state, I mean, you retain some kind of a connection to the core of our community, the core of our culture, which is retained by the elders here. So I think that that's really critical that communities are built around that kind of a core.
A lot of what we're talking about with the Hmong 40 Project is documenting the stories of the people, as we heard earlier a few minutes ago, earlier this hour, and the family and their trip to America. I want to, though, turn the tables here and talk about the way America received the Hmong, both in the late 70s up to today. And Sol, how have you seen that change in terms of here in the Central Valley or even beyond, how has America welcomed and accepted and embraced the Hmong people, and how has maybe that changed over the years?
I think just from my personal perspective, in the beginning, I think a lot of veterans who fought in Vietnam, they had a knowledge of the Hmong. And so when we came here, they knew who we were and what we contributed and sacrificed. And so I think they were welcoming. And I think as we have integrated over the years, a new generation has grown up, and they might not know so well who the Hmong are, why we came here. And so they might just take us for granted that, well, they're Americans, they're here, just like us. And so I think this is a chance for us to not only remind ourselves, but also the community of who we are, where we came from, and why we're here.
And Blong, as someone who is in local government and as you've had to work on all these sorts of different issues, you know, the first Hmong immigrants came to America in the 1970s, but it was not in just one wave. This continued, and I think the last group, when was the last group?
The last group really was about 2003. You look at the resettlement from Watakaba, and at that time I wasn't even in the politics of the city. I was working with a nonprofit, and we worked with a lot of community spearheaded that particular resettlement. But I'll tell you, it has been you look at from where the first group and how was the process resettled here when it was done traditionally through what the system here in the government has, right? They put you in cities where they think that they have employment, you can find a job. Well, resettlement that way is really probably not the best for this community. When this community, we resettled through community, right, where our elders are, where our community is. So even when we were put in Kirksville, Missouri, the only Asian family there probably, my dad automatically looked, okay, where was the rest of my community? Where was that? We need to be there. So it took about a year for him to find out where the community at that time was in Kansas City, Kansas. So that's really the larger picture of a resettlement that was done, and it learned, and the community had to learn. And, you know, I'll try to go quickly as I can, but even here in Fresno, when the community popped up, right, they didn't really originally settle in Fresno. They were in different parts of the area, San Diego, Santa Barbara, all those areas. And when they came to Fresno, you know, you started maybe with a couple of families. Well, the next thing you know, everybody said, oh, Fresno's the best place. You grew to 20, 25, 35,000 people. You can imagine the cultural shock that this community had. Next thing you know, you had a couple of Hmong families. You turn around in the neighbor, you're like, oh, you have 30, 40, 50,000 people. The community was not ready for the Hmong migration here. You saw some of the cultural issues. You saw the clash. You saw the valley that had to know who the Hmongs were, why they were here. And sometimes we take it for granted. We've been here 40 years, and we think that, oh, everybody here in the valley should know our Hmong story. But that's not true. It seems like we have to sometimes retell why we came, why we were here. And that continues to happen. And so, you know, with Laura, with Sol, they each bring a different perspective, but it's still a Hmong story. And I think the 40 here will highlight some of that, and I think puts into a strong foundation as to our history here in the Valley and what that means.
You're hearing the voice of Blong Jong, former Fresno City Council member from District 1 from 2007 to 2015. We're also joined in our studio today by local author and poet Sol Vang. He's the author of the book of poems called To Live Here, also a teacher and U.S. Army veteran, has an MFA from Fresno State. And also Lar Yang, the project director for Hmong Story 40. 2015 marks the 40th anniversary of the Hmong migration to the United States, and the community throughout the Central Valley is celebrating this occasion, gathering stories, artifacts,
fine art and other memories of the past 40 years and beyond. Laura, I want to turn to you now and talk about the Hmong as they came to America. What was the vision of America? We often hear about people abroad having an idea of America as sometimes it's movie stars, sometimes it's New York City and the Statue of Liberty. Was there a vision for America, and was there a vision for the Hmong people about what this new land was going to be for them?
You know, that's a very interesting point. I came here very early, and I didn't really know what to expect. But from a lot of the oral stories that we've conducted with the elders, a lot of them said that inside the camps, as they were getting ready to come to America, a lot of them did not want to come because it's kind of like an uncertainty, you know, not even knowing what America was like. And then coming here, and it's a cultural shock, you know. If anything, they wanted to go back to their motherland. But, you know, through this transition, through this migration, and what we find out through this story of the Hmong story is it's just an immigrant story. You know, immigrants have been coming to America that's the whole history of America. And it's really, really prevalent here in the Central Valley because the fabric of the Central Valley is threaded by immigrant experiences. And that's something that we want to show, is that this is reflective of the American dream, the American pursuit. It's just through the eyes of the Hmong experience, you know, and we want to really showcase that. We want to use the written history, the academic history, to frame the context, but to really give the heart and soul of this experience is to really give voices and to give a platform for these personal stories of people who've survived and endured and really, you know, thrived and accomplished through this process.
Turning now to Sol Vang and following up on what Lar just was talking about in the relationship between the Hmong experience in America and other immigrant groups. Many of those immigrant groups, in fact, I think just about all of them, also face this dilemma as they move forward, as generations move on, the debate between assimilation and tradition and preserving those traditions. How would you say the Hmong community is dealing with that issue today, and how big of an issue is it right now? Is it a concern, and what's the state of the situation right now?
I think it is a big issue. It's very hard to pick and choose what to keep and what to cast away what to put aside. And so I think as a storyteller, we have a chance to pick and choose what stories to emphasize. And I think through those stories, what values, what strong values we have will be passed on. And I think, speaking as a writer, one thing I'm very proud of is the group I'm with, the Hmong American Writers Circle. We are growing, and we are, you know, more storytellers are graduating from the MFA programs, from other programs. And so I think as we have more storytellers, we're gonna focus on what is important and what is memorable, and so we're going to cultivate those stories and keep those stories and pass it on. And so it's a way for us to kind of really keep the tradition going.
Speaking of stories, Blong was telling us briefly about how his family wound up in Missouri. What's your story, Sol? How did your family come, and how did you come to where you are today?
I'm not sure if I should tell this story, but
that means it's a good one.
Back in the refugee camp, my mother heard the rumor that in America you only eat bread and butter, so she didn't want to come, and so she almost stayed behind. But we came to Hawaii, and when we first came to Hawaii, there was like probably 100 families, and then within a year, we spread out throughout the U.S., each family trying to find their clan or their relatives. So like Blong said, you know, the support group, the structure is the family, the clan. And so as a result, people kind of come to California, come to Minnesota, come to Denver. And so it's a very natural flow of immigration and lives.
Blong, you were nodding when Sol mentioned the rumor about only eating bread and butter.
Well, that's just not one of the stories. I mean, you look at, you know, the cities, America's paved in gold, or they have abundant salt, or you're afraid of the tall, white, long-nosed people that will eat your people, right? I mean, the story goes on and on. and on. So you know, even before we landed in America, there were already obstacles for us to come. But at the end of the day, that's why, as I've said earlier, I give credit to those that made the track that came here, whether by force or not, but you know, to give families. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, for us, as the opportunities when we look at education, you know our community in the old countries, let alone our daughters, but even for boys, you know, having educational opportunities are very limited. If you're not smarter, or if you're not one of the elder son, or you have the money, education that doesn't come that freely or attainable. So this country give all of us, and I don't, you know, for the three of us here, if we didn't come to this country, I'm not sure you'll see us here at this level. We, you know, I would probably be a very bad farmer. Let's just put it that way. They probably would survive, but me, I would probably not make it as a farmer. And so thank goodness that my father and my parents brought me to this country.
And turning now to you, Lar, maybe your story. We've heard from the other two gentlemen here about their personal reflections on their family and their experience coming here. You said you were very, very young.
I came over when I was four, and we landed in San Diego. And the thing that I remember most about my childhood is Vietnam was very fresh, and so we faced a lot of discrimination. You know, that why are you guys here? You're part of the Vietnam War. And I didn't even know what was happening at that time, you know, until we started doing this research. And I tried very hard to just become very mainstream, to be very successful, you know. And I think in a lot of us, through this pursuit of trying to be the best American that we can be, trying to be successful in college and business, we put our culture on the back burner, you know. And then somewhere along the line, I mean, within the last couple of years, we realized that if not our group to really preserve our culture, who would how would this survive in the next generation, you know?
And speaking of preserving that culture and those stories, tell us about the work that you're doing right now with the Hmong Story 40 Project and what's coming up later this year.
Yeah, you know, this started about 2 years ago. A few of us knew that 40 years was coming, and we were like, how can we do something really magnificent to really celebrate, you know, that momentous event? And then we started just talking about amongst a group of friends, and then everybody was like, wow, this could be something so phenomenal. And you know, more and more people started gravitating toward it, because this project does not just benefit one person. It's a collective that benefits the whole community, you know. I'll just state one statement that Dr. Gomes said, and it kind of summarizes collectively what we're trying to do. He says that a people without a history is like a tree without a root, you know. And so much of all the efforts that we're doing is really to really build our history, and then to package it, and then to give it as a gift to our people, to the younger generations, and also to the community at large, because it celebrates so many different things.
And tell us specifically, you have the event coming up at the end of this year. When
yeah.
is that? And then it goes to other locations.
Yeah. So two years, the 2 year project is going to culminate into a 1 month exhibit at the Fresno Fairgrounds. It's going to open up on December 12th. We don't have the specific dates locked down, but the venue is set. It's going to open there for 4 weeks. So it's going to open up 2 weeks before the Hmong New Year, and then it's going to go through the Hmong New Year, so that the audience can really, really come and celebrate it as well. And then it's going to be a traveling exhibit that's going to showcase in Merced in May for 3 weeks at the fairgrounds there. And then it's going to go to a museum in Sacramento in the fall, and then it'll be open for four weeks as well there.
If people want more information about that project, what should they
do? Yes, they can follow us on social media. Just search the Hmong Story 40 Project, or you can go to the website, www.hmongstory40.org. And on there, you please view the videos. The videos kind of really summarize it. There's some marketing videos that really encapsulate what we're doing, and then there's a lot of oral stories that we've kind of captured in there for you to view.
We've been speaking with Lar Yang. He's the Hmong Story 40 Project Director. Also with us today, Sol Vang. He is a local poet and author of the Book of Poems To Live Here, also a MFA poetry graduate from California State University, Fresno, and a member of the editorial board of the Hmong American Writers Circle, also the co-editor of How Do I Begin, a Hmong American Literary Anthology.
and former Fresno City Council member Blong Zhang, who represented District 1 in Fresno from 2007 to 2015. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on the 40th anniversary.
Thank you for this opportunity.
This is Valley Edition. Stay with us. We'll be back in just one moment and learn more about how avocado farmers in California are dealing with the drought in a surprising way. That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. You probably noticed farmers are being widely criticized during the California drought because agriculture uses a big chunk of the state's water supply. But some farmers are cutting back by employing new techniques. Leslie McClurg visited an avocado grower who's using half as much water to yield twice as much fruit.
It wasn't long ago that avocados were a luxury crop, but the fruit's popularity has soared in recent years, demonstrated by the sandwich chain Subway. For the last several years, the featured sub has included avocados.
I'm totally in love with the avocado on the sub.
I love avocado so much, I started a Facebook page.
Guacamole. If an avocado was grown in the U.S., it most likely ripened in California, where 90% of the nation's crop originates. The majority of the state's groves are in San Diego County, and the heart is the small town of Escondido. The Avocado Grill is a popular place to eat downtown. Sliced, diced, or pureed avocados dress up everything on the menu.
You guys decided on everything today?
The grilled avocado caprese sandwich and chips and guacamole.
Posters in the restaurant tout the nutritional value of avocados. Colorful boxes highlight that the fruit is sodium and cholesterol-free, plus it's full of good fats. Nick Staley's avocado farm is about 20 minutes outside of town at the end of a long, twisting road. Numerous farms along the way have been deserted. They're now barren hillsides. I caught up with him working in a small grove of avocado trees. He says weeds can suck up a lot of water, and he's protecting every drop he can. He's removing trees and fallowing fields on two-thirds of his 800-acre farm this year.
Literally shut stuff off, or like all that wood out there were trees once upon a time.
He points to a pile of dead lemon trees that will be cut into firewood soon. Below the wood pile is an empty pond. He says he's never weathered a drought like this one in nearly 50 years of farming.
Well, it is. It's worrying. I mean, it's a booger to sleep at night sometimes, worrying that your crop will hold on and take care of the water prices and stuff like that.
He's paying about $1,600 for an acre foot of water. That's an all-time high, and it's nearly the most expensive water in the state. He says at that price, he can hardly break even growing avocados. But he's not ready to give up.
But yeah, you got avocados in your blood, it's hard to get rid of them sometimes.
Staley is hopeful that a new growing technique might save him. The mastermind is Gary Bender, a University of California avocado specialist and farm advisor in San Diego County.
So the idea is, what's our maximum yield per acre so we can actually pay these water bills and keep these guys in business?
Bender's answer is higher density planting. Instead of the standard distance of 20 feet apart, he just ran a trial where he planted trees 10 feet apart. And then instead of letting the trees grow tall, which is the standard practice, he pruned them regularly to keep the trees short and fat, kind of like a Christmas tree farm.
We're producing twice as much fruit for a little bit less water.
This seems easy. Why hasn't it been done before?
Sounds pretty simple, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We've been growing avocados wrong all these years, and we're finally starting to figure it out.
The study was a huge success, yielding nearly 13,000 pounds of Haas avocados per acre.
We're producing twice as much fruit for a little bit less water.
Nick Staley hopes the higher density planting could be the key to staying in business.
Oh, it's fantastic news. Get these trees to grow and produce. It's again, any farmer's going to like that, that's for sure.
Bender is optimistic about the second harvest. He points to numerous sprouting blossoms in the trial grove.
We actually counted. We got 1 million flowers on a tree.
He says higher density trials are starting in other crops like apples, olives, and mandarins. Close plantings haven't been popular in California in the past because it's easier to harvest and spray pesticides when trees are farther apart. But traditional methods don't work as well in a drought.
I really think if we're going to stay in avocados, especially in the high water price districts, we're going to have to go to something like this.
I'm Leslie McClurg.
we close our show today with a commentary as part of our series, The Moral Is. The horrific killings in January at the offices of the Charlie Hebdo magazine inspired commentators to defend speech and press freedoms as absolutes. But in this edition of The Moral Is, CSU Bakersfield philosophy professor Christopher Myers says free speech needs to be balanced against other moral concerns.
In the wake of January's shocking murders at Charlie Hebdo's Paris offices, CBS anchor Scott Pelley departed from his reporter stance to provide a brief commentary on the shootings and on press freedom. It was powerful stuff, eloquently written and spoken. Unfortunately, it was also seriously misguided. He was right when he said, "There is no democracy without journalism, and the strength of a people depends on the quality of their information." And he correctly showed the connection between a press corps and these basic rights. Silence, he noted, is the end of freedom. Where he went wrong was when he concluded that, unlike most of our other cherished freedoms, the freedom to publish and speak, he said, is absolute. One must assume he was caught up in the horror of the moment. He surely knows that speech, like all freedoms, is qualified against other moral considerations, particularly the harm such speech may cause. In the famous words of Justice Holmes, one does not have the right to falsely shout fire in a crowded theater. The Supreme Court has since translated that metaphor into the prevailing standard that speech or publication may be restricted when it represents a clear and present danger to the public. Did Charlie Hebdo's actions rise to that standard? Was their decision to publish additional images, despite extremists' reaction to earlier ones, reckless? Were there credible threats, credible enough that a reasonable person would likely conclude that continued publication represented a clear and present danger? And if so, should they have given in to those threats? Heroic journalists worldwide face mortal threats every day. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 61 were killed in 2014 simply for doing their job, acquiring and disseminating the information necessary for democracies to prevail. We are in their debt, just as we are to the thousands of others who step into that fray every day. But what about the accidental victims who did not sign up for that danger? At Charlie Hebdo, those included Frederic Boisseau, a building maintenance worker killed in the lobby, Michel Reynaud, a friend visiting one of the cartoonists, and Ahmed Merabet, a Paris police officer who rushed to the scene to provide assistance. They were not journalists. They did not commit to the often heroic call to inform the public. Rather, they just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they died for it. Knowing this changes the equation for me. To my mind, it does not appear Charlie Hebdo's management adequately addressed just how serious the threat was, particularly to innocent bystanders. It also shows that Pelley's journalistic absolutism is mistaken. Free expression, as vital as it is, must sometimes be weighed against other moral concerns. For The Moral Is, this is Christopher Myers.
Christopher Myers is a professor of philosophy and executive director of the Kegley Institute of Ethics at California State University, Bakersfield. The views expressed are his own and don't necessarily represent those of the university or the Institute or Valley Public Radio. The Moral Is commentary series is produced by KVPR and the Bonner Center for Character Education at Fresno State. See more commentaries online at kvpr.org. And that does it for today's Valley Edition. Thanks for joining us. You can find our podcasts and audio archives on our website at kvpr.org. You can also tweet us at KVPR and at Valley Edition and send us an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org. We'd like to thank our staff, Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver. I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.